It's really kind of amazing how quickly life can change, and you can maybe think of examples from your own life. I think back to a day several years ago. We were having a church working bee, and I was doing some plastering in the chapel. We had salt damp and tearing that out and putting new plaster in, so I could do the same thing probably in 6 months, more than likely. Others were scattered all around the property up in Broken Hill. We had a convent was where the church was. And then, just like that, everything changed. A plank slipped. There was a crash of glass. And some of you know Wilbur Butler fell and landed on his heels and then went back and hit his head on the pavement. I came around the corner and people standing there and I can still see it in my mind's eye today, a long stream of blood running down the pavement and Wilbur laying there and the scream of ambulance sirens as they came, and nobody knew what was going to happen. You know, it was just a Saturday like everything. I had my sermon prepared for the next day, and what I'm going to say tonight was actually what I ended up saying the next day.
Water's back on.
Thank you, McHugh.
Beautiful. And it's moments like that that can really shake us to the core. You know, as individuals, things happen. As communities of people, things happen. And one thing that we can count on in life is that we're going to encounter problems. Ecclesiastes has a really interesting image of it. It talks about how, like a net, you know, just fish is swimming along in the ocean, bang, next moment it's caught. And that's one of the big messages, I think, of Ecclesiastes, is that you can't stop bad things from happening. You can live wisely and stop a few of the bad things from happening in life, but ultimately life is outside of your control. You can't understand what God is up to. God twists things like big steel girders, and there's no way you're going to untwist them. And so what's the response when things like that happen? Life gets shaken. Talked a little bit about it this morning, but you know, people in our churches, ourselves, there'll always be somebody who has some sort of an issue, somebody who's going through chemotherapy, radiation, somebody who's having car problems, somebody who's having relationship problems, people moving away, people shaken financially and all that. And what I want to do tonight is just not probably do anything new or profound, but just to remind us of truths that we probably already know. And I want to take this psalm, Psalm 46, and I want to weave together this psalm with the story of one of Judah's kings in the Old Testament. And hopefully we'll be able to gain some encouragement for our lives. Psalm 46 begins by reminding us that when our lives are shaken, we have nothing to fear because God is with us. When our lives are shaken, we've got nothing to fear because God is with us. And the psalm begins by asserting three basic truths about God. And we take them together, and they all add up to say that when we get shaken, we can turn to God. God is our refuge. I suppose I should read the heading. For the director of music of the sons of Korah, according to Alamot, a song. God is God is our refuge and strength, an ever-present help in trouble. He says, first of all, God is our refuge. What's a refuge? Think of any images of what a refuge is.
Safe place.
Okay, safe place, safe house. Yep. Okay, somewhere where you're going to be protected.
Okay.
Okay, could be a cave. Yep. In a storm, something like that.
Strong, secure place.
Okay. Yep.
When I was about 18, I had a guy try to abduct me off the street.
Oh, wow.
In Melbourne. And there was a couple turned up.
Wow.
I walked with them. They were a refuge. I was so glad to see them.
Wow. Wow. We used to have, when I was a kid in primary school, there was a program, the Blue Star Home. And so if somebody was trying to abduct you, you went to, if you saw a house that had this blue star in the window, you could knock on the door. And they'd been checked, and they'd happily take any kid in off the street right then. Yeah, good example. The same word refuge is used in Psalm 104, verse 18. So bless your socks. The high mountains belong to the wild goats. The crags are a refuge for the conies. Doesn't that just bless you? But you've been to Israel. You know what a coney is? Does somebody had a photo of a coney this morning, or was that yesterday at college? Yeah, it's kind of like a big guinea pig, big brown guinea pig. They're called hyrax is another one. I've seen them in Ethiopia as well. They're called a rock badger. And both times I've been to Israel, I've seen these critters. The first time there's a castle ruins, Crusader castle up in the north, and there's all of these rocks, big stone cut stones, and the conies are there, running in and out of the rocks. This last trip I was over in March and En Gedi, where David used to hide out from Saul, with all the caves and these things everywhere. And the interesting thing about them, Proverbs 30:26 says, conies are creatures of little power, yet they make their home in the crags. So you look at a coney and it just looks like a big guinea pig. It doesn't have big teeth. It doesn't have nasty sharp claws or anything. I wouldn't try to grab one. They're not particularly fast. But what they do is that they stay close to the rocks. And if a predator comes or something, they scamper into this place, this refuge in the rocks. And I think we can learn a lesson, or we can maybe have a picture about a refuge just from looking at this little animal. Again, we're not that strong, very similar to this morning. We're not that clever. We can't always handle the stuff that happens to us on our own. And when we're shaken, we need a refuge. We need a place that we can run and we can hide. And this psalm says that God is our refuge. Interesting, just tracing that word, and it's a noun, related verb, occurs in Isaiah 30. And the king that I want to talk about tonight is King Hezekiah. King Hezekiah is the king of Judah. Judah was being shaken. Hezekiah was being shaken. The Assyrians, who are the superpower of the day, are threatening Hezekiah and Judah. And apparently, Hezekiah and the nobility are all being tempted not to trust in God first and foremost, but to go down to Egypt and to take refuge in the Egyptians, to work out this little scheme with their little minds to save their little lives. But the problem is, apparently, they were leaving God out. You might have a look at Isaiah chapter 30. Isaiah 30, verses 1 and 2. Woe to the obstinate children, declares the Lord, to those who carry out plans that are mine, forming an alliance, but not by my spirit, heaping sin upon sin, who go down to Egypt without consulting me, who look for help to Pharaoh's protection, to Egypt's shade for refuge. That's our word. So rather than looking to God for refuge, first and foremost, they're trying to work all of this out through political alliances and that. Here they've got this incredible resource. They've got Almighty God, and they're running down to Egypt for help. It'd be kind of like, I won't do a coaching player coach thing today, but I will say... I don't know, any Adelaide Crows fans, Port Power fans, whatever. It'd be like having Patrick Dangerfield available or Scott Thompson available for selection, and they choose me instead. I mean, why in the world would you ever do something like that? And that's kind of what is happening here. I mean, they've got God available for selection, and they choose Pharaoh instead. One commentator says... he's actually speaking to Hezekiah and to Judah. All your human conniving can't save you. Your only resource is God, and the good news is he wants to save you. Indeed, he will, so why go to Egypt? Maybe this is a message that we need to hear as well. You know, when we get shaken, it could be that there are times when we're shaken that we kind of forget God, we leave Him out of the picture, we focus on, you know, what do I need to do? And I'm speaking from personal experience. What do I need to do? What are my resources? Who can I enlist? All of this kind of stuff. Instead of realizing that even though some of those things are good and they'll come into the equation at some point, it's not the starting point. Not the starting point. God is our refuge. And all of our plans, all of our wisdom, all of our resources will come into nothing unless God's in charge. Psalm 46:1 also says that God is our strength. And so we think about how strong God is, and it's really kind of a ridiculous thing to think of. How strong is God? Well, we've got an unlimited reservoir of power. We've got the one who merely spoke, and everything in creation came to be. So we're talking about a lot of power. We're talking about the person who holds every atom of the universe in place. One of my favorite passages from Paul's writings is Ephesians 1:19-20. Paul's got this prayer. He says, "Now that the eyes of your heart have been enlightened, I pray that you would know." And he has three things he wants the Ephesians to know. The last one he says, "That you may know His incomparably great power for us who believe. That power is like the working of His mighty strength, which He exerted in Christ when He raised Him from the dead and seated Him at His right hand in the heavenly places." Paul's telling the Ephesians, "I just wish that you could know, and that's my prayer for you, that you might realize the power that's available to you, the same power that raised Jesus from the dead." And then he goes on in chapter 2 and he says, "This is actually the same power that has raised you from the dead and brought you to life." And earlier, Randall, you were saying He's waiting. We're waiting. We're waiting. It's kind of like that with God. You know, we have this problem. We have this situation. He's waiting. He's waiting. He's waiting. But we'll never see His power until we come to the end of ourselves and ask Him for help. That's really one of the good things about problems. Is problems can bring us to the end of ourselves. Yeah. Yeah. And they can get us to see reality in ways that we can't often see them. John Bunyan said, "You can do more than pray after you pray, but you cannot do more than pray until you have prayed." I'll read that again. "You can do more than pray after you've prayed, but you cannot do more than pray until you have prayed." So there's plenty of time to do, but putting first things first is prayer. Augustine said, "Pray as though everything depended on God. Work as though everything depended on you." But I think the order there is probably significant as well. So God is our refuge. God is our strength. Third, God is an ever-present help in trouble. Our English translations stop right there. Does anybody have anything after that? In your English translation?
It's well proved.
Is well proved? Okay. All right. Literally, the Hebrew is found. Is found to be. So it's same idea. So, but it's interesting that we've left that off, I think. Literally, it says, "An ever-present help in trouble, He is found." Mm-hmm. So to paraphrase that, God will never let you down in any and every situation where you find yourself in. He's also going to be a true source of help if you trust Him. You will find Him to be that. And so when we take all of these three descriptions together, they lead us to the conclusion of verses 2 and 3. "Therefore, we will not fear though the earth give way and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam and the mountains quake with their surging." Selah. The implication is that because God is available to us, we can face even the most difficult problems that we might encounter in life. And he gives us the worst case scenario here. Has anybody ever been through an earthquake? I've been through the two little ones that we've had in Adelaide over the last couple of years in the middle of the night and think, what was that? Mm. Oh, I'll go back to bed. But you've been through an earthquake?
In India, yeah.
Yeah.
Everything shook.
And how's that make you feel?
Oh, yeah, under the bed in about 2 seconds.
Okay. Mm. Yeah, I hope I'm never through a major earthquake. But, I mean, what is more solid than the ground that we stand on? Mm. And in an earthquake, that all disappears. Mm. That shakes.
Who was in China during the earthquake there, and she said it was like the ground was boiling. Mm. Like bubbling and boiling. Mm.
Mm. Interesting. That's almost the description of how he describes the seas here. Mm-hmm. The mountains falling into the heart of the seas, the waters roaring and foaming.
It's like sandy. Huh. Like sandy.
Sandy.
Arkham Sandy.
Oh, sorry. I was trying to... My mind is not quick right now, actually. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Just the earth tossing, God tossing stuff around like rag dolls. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. That's the picture. If the worst thing that could possibly go wrong does go wrong. And the psalm writer says that even if that happens, we still don't have to fear if our confidence is in God. Now, we're not told anything. Some of the psalms tell us in the superscription what the setting of the psalm is. We're not told anything about it. But many scholars think that this could well describe the situation of King Hezekiah. During his reign, Judah was shaken to the core. In fact, they shouldn't have survived. It looked like they wouldn't survive. Just a few years before, the northern tribes had been carried off into exile by the Assyrians, a different king. And let's take a look at 2 Chronicles 32. If the chronology is right, or if my understanding is right, initially Hezekiah and the people of Judah were going to go down to Egypt to form this alliance. But they really got backed into a corner. And apparently Hezekiah obeyed when God said not to do that. But eventually, the inevitable happened, and the Assyrians attacked. So, 2 Chronicles 32, verse 1. After all that Hezekiah had done, so faithfully done. I'll read that again. I've got this underlined, because I think that's a key statement in this story. After all that Hezekiah had so faithfully done. It doesn't quite seem right. Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came and invaded Judah. He laid siege to the fortified cities, thinking to conquer them for himself. And there's a real irony in that, that after everything that Hezekiah had done, I mean, Hezekiah is one of these really faithful guys. His grandfather was Manasseh, a terrible king. His father was Ammon, another bad king who was assassinated. And then Hezekiah comes on the scene, and he's just this wonderful king. And he gets rid of all of the idolatry, teaches the law and all that in the land, reinstitutes the Passover. And we wouldn't expect that after he's done all of these faithful things, this bad stuff happens. The last three chapters go into detail about that. Sennacherib then, king of Assyria, invades the land. And if you know the story, really Jerusalem is the only city that's left. The whole country of Judah has been conquered by Sennacherib. And the ground is shaking underneath his feet. Buildings are toppling. Waves are crashing down on his head. And how does he respond? Verse 6. He appointed military officers over his people, assembled them before him in the square of the city gate, encouraged them with these words, "Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or discouraged because of the king of Assyria and the vast army with him, for there is a greater power with us than with him. With him is only the arm of flesh, but with us is the Lord our God to help us and to fight our battles." The people gained confidence from what Hezekiah, the king of Judah, said. That's pretty good. That's one of the few places in the Old Testament where God's people and the king really nail it. Hezekiah says, "Men, you see those Assyrians out there? A couple hundred thousand Assyrian soldiers. You see those guys out there? There's more of us in here than there are out there. Because we've got them outnumbered. They've just got the puny arm of flesh, but we've got the Lord our God." And he had gotten hold of that concept. God plus one is always a majority. Back in Psalm 46, "God is our refuge and strength, our ever-present help in trouble. Therefore we will not fear, though the earth give way and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam and the mountains quake with their surging." And I wonder if we have gotten hold of that concept. You know, when our lives get shaken, when the lives of the people around us get shaken, where do we turn? Mountains tremble, waves are crashing down on our head. It's a really important question, I think, because sooner or later, it doesn't matter who we are, sooner or later, it's inevitable. It's going to happen to us. It's going to happen to the people that we know. It's just the way life is. Those situations are going to arise that eventually are going to bring us to the end of ourselves. Psalm 46 says that we have nothing to fear because God is with us. And the next section of the psalm goes on to tell us that God is completely reliable and a source of help. Verse 4. "There's a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy place where the Most High dwells." God seems to be portrayed here as a river. It seems like it's an image because there isn't a river in Jerusalem. There's a spring and there's water that Hezekiah had something to do with bringing into the city, but there's no river. And that's a big theme in the Bible, in the Old Testament especially, the whole issue of water, very similar to Australia. Water's a really big issue, huge issue in Israel. And a lot of times, I mean, when we first went to Broken Hill, we were under the illusion that creeks had water in them. Back in the States, creeks were bodies of water. We come here and creeks are places filled with sand and trees where you go have a barbecue. And then we did realize, oh, okay, there's a couple days a year that there's water in it. In the Middle East, they have things called wadis, which are very similar. And I think there's a bit of a contrast here between those types of water bodies that are only full of water every so often versus God, who is a reliable, consistent, steady flow of water, can be relied upon. And I think this image fits Hezekiah really well, because when the Assyrians attacked, came into Judah, all of the people from the countryside, many of them would have left their towns, would have flooded in from the countryside, and Jerusalem would have just swelled inside. So they had a need for water that needed to be supplied, and you probably know the story of Hezekiah and Hezekiah's tunnel. There's the Gihon Spring, and they started at opposite ends, and they dug through about half a kilometer of solid rock, and they met in the middle. They kind of, toward the end, they kind of went like that. But they met in the middle. I mean, this is 710 B.C., something like that. Yeah, excellent, isn't it? Yeah, if I had slides, I'd bring my photos. I mean, if I had a projector, but we could compare photos. Yeah, it's a wonderful thing to do. Who's walked through Hezekiah's tunnel? No, just me and Grant. My wife actually went through. She surprised me. I didn't think she'd do that. But that's something that would have been very significant for Hezekiah. God is like that crystal clear spring water flowing into Jerusalem. He provides for all of their needs. He sustains them. He gives them life. That's the picture. Verses 5 and 6 then promise that God is going to help. He's going to defend his people. God is within her. She will not fall. God will help her at break of day. Nations are in uproar. Kingdoms fall. He lifts his voice. The earth melts. We have to temper this a little bit because I think we could come away with the wrong idea that says that God is always going to deliver us from all of our problems. And we probably need to make the distinction between through and from, if you get that idea. God doesn't promise to keep us from problems, but he does promise to help us through problems. I think a really good example of this is another psalm, Psalm 16. And I think it's probably a typological, prophetic sort of a psalm where David's talking about a situation in his own life, and he says, God will not abandon my soul to Sheol. And I think probably the right way to take that is initially to take that to David, that he's talking about some life-threatening situation that he was in. And in the midst of that situation, he had the confidence that God wasn't going to allow him to die. So he was going to be kept from death. But it's very obvious by the New Testament that God had in mind the Messiah as well, because both Peter and Paul quote that in their preaching, and I think Peter at least learned his hermeneutics from Jesus, so he probably was using the psalm properly. And in Jesus' case, Jesus wasn't delivered from death, but he was delivered through death. And so sometimes God does deliver us from, other times he does deliver us through, if that makes sense. Probably that idea is brought out in verse 5 pretty well. It says, God will help her at the break of day, or God will help her toward morning. What comes before morning?
Darkness.
Oftentimes a long, dark, scary, stressful night comes before morning.
Talk about deliverance. I was just on the other day in Philippians, and Paul said that, I know this will turn out for my deliverance. And the deliverance was that Christ will be exalted in his body, whether by life or by death. So, yeah. In deliverance, in the affliction there.
Good parallel.
Yeah.
I probably shouldn't. No, I won't go there. I don't want to get myself in trouble. You know what Hezekiah had to go through before God delivered him? I mean, the story ends well. If you know the story of Hezekiah, all's well that ends well. But he had to watch helplessly as town after town after town after town fell to the Assyrians. He had to hear the report of cities being burned, of populations being exported. He could look out over the city walls and see wooden stakes with his subjects impaled on them, which is something that the Assyrians did to kind of intimidate the people in the cities that they were besieging. In the end, God did come through, but there was a long, dark, scary night that Hezekiah went through. And our consolation in the midst of that is that even though we sometimes go through those nights, God is with us. God is in the midst. I like the imagery of verse 6. It says, nations roar, and then God roars. So the nations roared like a lion, and the Assyrians, interestingly, if you look at some of their reliefs, their stone reliefs and stuff, lions were really important to the Assyrians. The kings are often shown on lion hunts, and the kings are killing lions and things like that. So lions were really big. They thought they were the lion kingers, the lion-like nation. So Sennacherib roared like a lion. Listen to what he says. Go back to Chronicles 32. I should have told you to keep your finger there. Chronicles 32, verse 13. This is Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, roaring. Do you not know what I and my fathers have done to all the peoples of the other lands? Were the gods of those nations ever able to deliver their land from my hand? Who of all the gods of these nations that my father destroyed has been able to save his people from me? How then can your God deliver me from my hand? Now don't let Hezekiah deceive you and mislead you like this. Do not believe him, for no God of any nation or kingdom has been able to deliver his people from my hand or the hand of my fathers. How much less will your God deliver you from my hand? That's Sennacherib's roar. But God roared back even louder. I like that. Verse 6 says, He lifts His voice, the earth melts. Great imagery. Who's got the loudest roar?
Verse 6 of 7?
Sorry, back in Psalm 46.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, sorry. I knew where I was going. So God is powerful. God is personal. God protects His people. Verse 7, the Lord Almighty, back in Psalm 46. The Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Selah. I hear the Lord Almighty is literally Yahweh of hosts. Yahweh is the personal name of God. Yahweh is the covenant name of God. And it probably communicates that He is the one who is present, who is there to do whatever His people might need Him to do, whatever His people's hour of need calls for, that's what He'll be for them. Of hosts communicates what?
Armies.
God is the one surrounded by the armies of heaven. Thousands and thousands of angels surrounding Him. When Jesus was arrested in the garden, what did He say? He could have called 12 legions of angels. And the Father would have sent Him. That's 72,000 angels. Jesus could have called from the Father, and the Father would have sent them. That's a pretty impressive army. God is also the God of Jacob, Israel's ancestor. God had protected and helped Jacob all through his life and blessed his family, promised to bless his family forever. And then finally, God is a fortress and a stronghold. A stronghold is literally like a secure high place, an inaccessibly high place. Have you been to Masada as well, Grant?
Masada?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Masada is on the Dead Sea, on the west coast of Masada, on the Dead Sea. You know Masada? You've seen pictures of it? It's just this massive rock that rises up from the Dead Sea, and real steep slopes. You used to just be able to get up through what they call the snake path that winds up. Very easy place to defend. Probably David knew this place. Today you can just get on a gondola and ride up to the top, cable car, in about a minute. But a really impressive place. All you had to do was get up on top of that, store up water, store up food, and you were set. You could ride out. And in 70 AD, the Jews rode out a long siege by the Romans. I think they held out for 9 months up on top of Masada before the Romans broke in. And that's what this psalm has in mind here. God is a fortress. God is the ultimate in protection. When everything around us is shaking, when the waves are crashing down on our head, then God is that person who is able to lift us out and to set us up on an inaccessibly high place. And so Hezekiah, back in the story in 2 Chronicles, Hezekiah goes to his high place. He goes to his fortress. He goes into the temple. When he heard the threat of Sennacherib, it says that he tore his clothes. He took the letter that he'd been sent. He entered the temple. He spread that letter out before God, the God who is being ridiculed in that letter by the king of Assyria. And here's his prayer from 2 Kings 19. O Lord God of Israel, enthroned above, between the cherubim, You alone are God over all the kingdoms of the earth. You have made heaven and earth. Give ear, O Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, O Lord, and see. Listen to the words Sennacherib has sent to insult the living God. Now, O Lord our God, deliver us from his hand so that all nations on earth may know that You alone, O Lord, are God. And it says that that night, the angel of the Lord went out and killed 185,000 men in the Syrian camp. Now, most people don't believe this story. Most biblical scholars don't believe this story when they read it. But that's what the text says. 185,000 men killed in the middle of the night. And then Sennacherib goes home, and you get the idea that he was assassinated by his two sons shortly after. It was actually 20 years later. 20 years later, Sennacherib was assassinated by two of his sons. so much for his ability to conquer all of the gods of all of the nations. Because God is with us, we have nothing to fear. Because God is reliable, we can count on him to come through when we need him the most. So the next question is, practically speaking, what do we do when our lives are shaken? What do we do? The answer from Psalm 46 is we need to remember and we need to relax. We need to remember, we need to relax. Verse 8, back in Psalm 46. Come and see the works of the Lord, the desolations he has brought on the earth. He makes wars cease to the ends of the earth. He breaks the bow. He shatters the spear. He burns the shields with fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Selah. The first piece of instruction here is remember. Verse 8 says, come and see the works of the Lord. Remind yourself what God has done for you in the past. And that's one of the things that just quite simply I'm trying to do this evening is to get us to take a look at this snapshot in the past of something incredible that God has done in the past. It's almost like the writer is saying, if this is the same time period of Hezekiah, and again, we don't know, step outside the walls of Jerusalem and have a look around. Tents flapping in the breeze, pots and pans scattered all over the place, the occasional donkey or horse nibbling away at a tuft of grass, 185 bodies lying dead on the ground. Flies buzzing everywhere. That's something that God actually did in the past. And I think it's a pretty healthy thing for us on a regular basis to think back on our own lives and to think, you know, what has God done for me in the past? It's one of the good things about the message that I did this morning with Psalm 23 is I actually did that for that preparing that message, saying, you know, what are some of the things that God had? Oh, yeah, God provided a car for us when we needed it. Oh, yeah, we were discouraged and we weren't going to have breakfast anymore, and God filled up our freezer. Oh, yeah, those are good things to remember. Actually, I get tears start to well up every time I think about the full freezer full of bakery goods. Why would God do that? Especially, you know, with the car, I was really kind of cranky with God. You know, probably a little bit out of place. But saying, God, this is what I need. And God, in his grace and his mercy, condescended to where we were and did something for us. So we need to first of all remember what God has done. And then secondly, we need to relax. Relax. Let the full awareness of who God is and what he will do in our situation flood into our minds and wash away those anxieties and fears. To be still literally means to sink or relax. New American Standard translates this as cease striving. Cease striving. It's often used in passages that talk about setting something down. So you're holding it and you just let your arms relax. You set it down. So give it a rest. Chill out, we might say. There's a verse in Job that uses this word for loosening the belt. Okay, so you know you've eaten a little bit too much curry tonight. And you know how that uncomfortable feeling where the curry and the rice is expanding and you try to suck your gut in so it doesn't look like you've eaten too much or you're overweight. You go home, you put your trackies on. Relax. Let the gut loose. That's the idea. Just relax. And it seems like the older I get, the more that God tries to teach me this lesson. I think probably when we're younger, you know, we think, well, I've got to develop these competencies in ministry. And it's true, we do have to develop competencies in ministry. You know, I have to be good in every area. I have to preach well. I have to counsel well. You know, I have to do this well. I have to be a good administrator. I have to solve people's problems. I have to be an evangelist. I've got to be a good apologist and answer questions. But really, that's probably a fallacy. You know, we don't have to be good at every single thing. And the most important thing is probably to trust Him. Again, it's not that we don't do those other things, and we don't plan and exercise wisdom, but the most important thing can often be the thing that we leave behind. We have an opportunity to show the world how great God is by trusting Him when we're in over our head. Mm-hmm. Found this story that I really like. A guy named Frederick Nolan was fleeing from enemies during a persecution in North Africa. And he'd been chased all over the countryside, over hill, through valley. And he finally fell exhausted in a cave. You said that was a refuge? Fell exhausted in a cave. He expected at any minute they were going to come and they were going to find him, they were going to kill him. And while he waited there on the floor of the cave, he saw a spider come. And a spider over the entrance of the cave wove a web. The people who were chasing him came. They saw the spider's web. They said, well, nobody would be in the cave because there's a spider's web. And he was miraculously delivered. And he exclaimed this. He said, where God is, a spider's web is like a wall. Where God is not, a wall is like a spider's web. The Lord is with us. The Lord is our refuge and our strength and ever-present help in times of trouble. And if we can just keep that in front of us, that should give us confidence when our world is shaken. Yeah. That's Psalm 46.